The 18th chapter of John's Gospel records the following exchange. Pilate then went back inside the palace, summoned Jesus, and asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" "Is that your own idea?" Jesus asked, "or did others talk to you about me?" "Am I a Jew?" Pilate answered. "It was your people and your chief priest who handed you over to me. What is it you have done?" Jesus said, "My kingdom is not of this world. If it were, my servants would fight to prevent my arrest. But now, my kingdom is from another place." "You are a king then," said Pilate. Jesus answered, "You are right in saying I am a king. In fact, for this reason I was born. And for this, I came into the world, to testify to the truth." "Truth?" Pilate asked. "What is truth?" With this, he went out to the Jews and said, "I find no basis for a charge against him." What is truth is a question that's being asked a lot these days. Jim McGuigan observes, "The genuine desire to obey enables to see things that we would have missed and evaporates many theological problems with the warm breath of eager submission." But what about a society that has replaced the genuine desire to obey God with the morality of culturally approved self-fulfillment? The society of which we're a part has not only moved away from a Christian worldview, where God's truth is the highest objective, but it has become actively antagonistic toward those who advance to seek an advanced faith. Do you feel any of this tension today? If you do, know that you're not imagining it. It is, in fact, real. David Kinnaman and our friend Gabe Lyons are two young visionaries whose organizations, the Barna Group and Q, interact with tens of thousands of Christian leaders from all walks of life and from various nonprofit, business, academic, and church sectors. In their new book, Good Faith, they write, "With our own eyes, we are seeing the facts on the ground. We work with business leaders who report experiencing disapproval from their own industry about the Christian way of life. We know educational leaders who have heard from accrediting organizations to tread carefully in the days to come. We're friends with pastors and ministers who are dealing with significant opposition from city and state governments. One, pictured here in Houston, was at the center of the case where ministers' sermons were subpoenaed by a mayor looking for ammunition to advance her own agenda. We've had long conversations with college professors and public officials who have had to guard what they say and how they see it for fear of professional repercussions. We've listened in on the pain of ministry leaders whose ministries are no longer welcome on college campuses across our country. We hear from Christian researchers who are blacklisted if they report findings that are out of step with culturally approved norms. We know business owners who have had to make agonizing decisions about how to or how not to apply their own deeply held principles in order to comply with legislation or public opinion. We have friends who did not get jobs because of their personal convictions. We hear regularly from Christian leaders who are wary of negative news coverage about their work. And even if we acknowledge that good journalism ought to dig into religion sins, the clergy abuse scandals come to mind, the leaders we serve are telling us that something is different in recent years. Some journalists are like faith-seeking missiles out to find, report, and destroy. And of course, there's the ever-present threat of a social media or PR disaster. It's a hyper-transparent world, but it's also a world that's hyper-critical of Christian leaders and organizations. And these are just a few of the slings and arrows directed toward Christians and Christian institutions. This is the tension that so many of us are feeling. But the tension is even more acute in our young people. In Barna's recent research, they report the following among millennials. 25% of non-Christian millennials believe that the Bible is, quote, a dangerous book of religious dogma that has been used for centuries to oppress people. 38% believe that the Bible is mythology, not to be literally believed. 30% say that the Bible is a book of fairy tales, not to be believed at all. So those of us who are older are wondering if our children and grandchildren are being lost when it comes to faith. We sense the tension of trying to express our faith in meaningful ways when so often it appears to be falling on deaf ears. It's almost as if we're speaking completely different languages. And Kinnaman and Lyons offer a compelling explanation of what is happening. They say, we believe that the problem is our culture's lack of a shared center. The bottom has dropped out. There is no center any longer. There's a giant vacuum in the middle of our moral and spiritual lives here in America. Now, we don't believe that there's any sort of massive anti-Christian conspiracy, but we do recognize a coherent and principled set of secular convictions that runs deeply counter to Christian belief. It may not be a coordinated effort, but let's not be naive. Those with a different worldview would love to fill this cultural vacuum with their notion of what is true. Now, if you're sitting there right now and you're not really sure in our country if there's ever been a shared moral center, consider a lesson from history. On March the 4th, 1865, about eight generations ago, newly elected President Abraham Lincoln delivered his second inaugural address, widely considered by historians to be one of the most important speeches ever given on American soil. References in this speech to both Old and New Testaments alike are peppered throughout. Lincoln alludes to Genesis chapter 3 in his criticism that slave owners would ask a just God's assistance in wringing their bread from the sweat of other men's faces. But then he adds, let us judge not, lest we be judged, quoting Jesus' words from Matthew 7, verses 1 and 2. He then repeats Jesus' warning in Matthew 18, woe to that man by whom offense cometh. And he affirms God's sovereignty over the devastating, still ongoing civil war by quoting from the 19th Psalm, yet the judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. The majority of President Lincoln's listeners and millions across the country who would read this address in newspapers would have instantly recognized these references. There was only one English version of the Bible at that time, the King James Version, and it was the only book that some Americans had ever read. Its impact and influence on American culture are hard to overestimate. A century and a half ago, the King James Version was called a conceptual canopy over the entire English-speaking world. But what if Lincoln were to give this iconic speech today? Well, first of all, many people would not get it. And it's not only because there is a cornucopia of English translations of the Bible. It's because so many people today are not at all familiar with the Bible. And if Lincoln delivered the second inaugural today, at least a few people would object to his use of the Bible to make these points. What about the separation of church and state? They would cry. And the fact that the entire speech is a meditation on God's will, that would raise some eyebrows too. But friends, not so long ago, this kind of language in public life was not exceptional. It was basically the norm. So if we're losing our shared center, what is it that's filling that hole? Well, we might call it the new code. For a couple of centuries of American public life, there has been a soft reliance on the state to tacitly endorse and approve of Christian values, and it seemed to work rather well. Since most people just assumed that America was a Christian nation, if such a thing can actually exist, it made sense that federal and state laws would give an affirmation of a biblical worldview and actively promote Christian morals. Laws from prohibitions against gambling, to alcohol, to tax exemption, to modesty laws, to blue laws, propped up nominal Christianity over the public square. And for the most part, everyone stayed buttoned up, and we appeared to be a virtuous people, a moral people. But things changed in the 20th century. More and more people started to see Christian morality as standing in the way of a new moral code, the morality of self-fulfillment. Throwing off these burdensome traditional mores, people began to imagine life without such a bothersome God standing watch. This was captured in the zeitgeist of the perennial hit by John Lennon. Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. And new research has highlighted the extent to which Americans are now pledging allegiance to this new moral code. And we can summarize it in six guiding principles. Number one, to find yourself, look within yourself. Number two, people should never criticize someone else's life choices. Number three, to be fulfilled in life, pursue the things that you desire most. Don't worry about your parents or your family or your God. Just do what you want to do. Number four, what's the highest goal of life? To enjoy yourself, to have a good time, to be happy. That's the most important thing to Americans today. Number five, people can believe anything they want as long as those beliefs don't affect society. So for you religious folks, be religious, but do that within the privacy of your own homes and don't tell us about it. Number six, any kind of sexual expression between two consenting adults is fine, and no one should tell us otherwise. The morality of self-fulfillment is everywhere. It's as ubiquitous as the very air that we breathe. Much of the time, we don't even realize that we're being constantly bombarded with messages that reinforce this self-fulfillment. In music, movies, video games, apps, commercials, TV shows, and every other kind of media. This me-focused morality is all the rage. And to see it, you merely need to look at two relationships that have historically required epic levels of self-sacrifice to succeed. The first is marriage, the second, parenting. Personal fulfillment has now taken center stage. So culturally, marriage has become about little more than how I feel when I'm with my spouse, how he or she completes me. And woe be to them if they stop completing me, just walk off and go find another one. Parenting has become similarly me-oriented. As marketing copy from one website shows, it states the following: parenting struggles are a perfect opportunity for personal growth. Use parenting as your path toward personal fulfillment and creating your best life. Wouldn't you just love to be the kids of those people? Well, as you can see in the next table, the church is not a lot different from society. The world has been bent on destruction about as long as there has been a world, but God's people should be exempt from this. But here's the problem that we face. Large percentages of practicing so-called Christians have embraced these principles of the new moral code. Look at some of the comparisons. Of the first one, that people should not criticize someone else's life choices. 89% of U.S. adults agree with that. 76% of practicing Christians agree with this. It's not much of a difference. The second point, to be fulfilled in life, you should pursue the things that you desire the most. 86% of Americans affirm, 72% of Christians agree. The highest goal of life is to enjoy it as much as possible. 84% of Americans say yes. So does 66% of Christians. You ever heard someone justify any kind of immorality? Well, you know, God just wants me to be happy. There it is. Number four, people can believe whatever they want as long as those beliefs don't affect society. 79% of Americans say yes. 61% of Christians agree. And the last one, any kind of sexual expression between two consenting adults is acceptable. 69% affirm. 40% of Christians affirm. Here's a prediction. 10 years from now, it'll be up in the 50s. 20 years from now, it'll probably be in the 70s. You can track the arc very easily. Dallas Willard diagnosed this spiritual sickness in his 2009 book entitled Knowing Christ Today. And he writes the following. The worldview answers that people now live by are provided by feelings, not by the Bible, but by feelings. Desire, not reality, and not what is good, rules our world. That's true for the most part, even with those who are religious. Most of what Americans do in their religion now is done at the behest of feelings. The quest for pleasure takes over the house of God. What is good or what is true is no longer the guide. Too many Christians have substituted comfortable living for a life changed by the gospel. And the government's tacit endorsement of vaguely Christian morals has made it difficult in many ways to discern what it means to be faithful beyond just showing up. So in recent years, this morality of self-fulfillment has begun to bear its inevitable fruit. People want to fulfill themselves by doing things outside the bounds of cultural Christianity. And they don't want the law telling them they can't. And if it does, well, then the law's got to be changed. And as a result of this shift, we're now seeing laws that endorse the broader culture's replacement of Christian morality with this moral code of self-fulfillment. And according to that moral code, any competing morality, say a religion like Christianity, that seeks to constrain someone's personal fulfillment must itself be constrained and neutralized. So if something or someone stands in the way of our fulfillment, that obstacle has to be removed. That person starts to represent the enemy, the embodiment of evil. So in a nutshell, society is telling us, keep your beliefs to yourself. Now, here's the problem. We can't live like that as God's people. We simply cannot. As the apostles said in the first century, we must obey God rather than men. And if we're going to be Christ's ambassadors today, it can be no different. So what then should be our answer to this wrong turn that society continues to make? Well, let's call this a return to God's moral order. In contrast to the dominant culture's embrace of self-fulfillment as the highest good, good faith Christians believe that living under God's moral order is the only thing that leads to human and societal flourishing. Not pretending that everything is okay, but going back and actually having a thus saith the Lord for what we do, for what we say, for what we believe. As the scripture says, physical training is of some benefit, but training for godliness is much better, promising benefits in this life as well as in the life to come. 1 Timothy 4 and verse 8. And yet the extent to which the morality of self-fulfillment has taken hold of the hearts and minds of practicing Christians today exposes an area of dangerous weakness in today's church. This grafting of cultural dogma onto Christian theology must stop. In order for us to flourish as God's people, His moral order must be allowed to rule our lives. So what are the principles of God's moral order? Well, let's contrast that former moral code that so many Americans are living by with some true statements about the way life ought to be. Statements with Jesus at the very center. Number one, to find yourself, discover the truth outside yourself in Jesus. Whatever we think, we are not the embodiment of truth. Jesus is. And my life will reflect truth to the same extent that it reflects Jesus. And if it doesn't, then I'm as lost as anyone else. Number two, loving others doesn't always mean remaining silent. Now, I'm not saying to go out on the street corner and start screeching and yelling at people. What we're saying is we have an obligation as God's ambassadors to teach and reflect truth. As Paul would say, have I become your enemy by telling you the truth? Well, you do for a lot of Americans, but we don't really have a choice as Christians. Number three, everyone wants to be happy. No, nothing wrong with that. But true joy is not found in pursuing our own desires, but in giving of ourselves to bless others. Answer this question honestly. What really makes you happy? Just being selfish and doing everything that you want to do? Or doing something to help someone else? We know inside our hearts the answer to that question. We simply need to start articulating it. Number four, the highest goal of life is not to be happy. It's to bring glory and honor to God. That's why we're here, friends. We're not here to be selfish and to be seekers of pleasure. We're here to glorify God. Number five, God gives people the freedom to believe whatever they want. It's a free country after all. But those beliefs always affect society. You know, the Supreme Court can pass whatever laws it wants to. But if they believe that any law they pass is for society's benefit, you couldn't find a bigger bunch of fools if they really think that, because that's simply not the case. And number six, God has designed boundaries for sex and sexuality, not to rob people of pleasure or to be a killjoy, but for their flourishing, for their benefit, for their blessing. In Isaiah 55, verses 8 and 9, the God and Father of us all reminds, for my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are my ways your ways. As the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my thoughts higher than your thoughts and my ways than your ways. You see, truth and morality are not within ourselves. They're rooted outside ourselves. Oprah Winfrey famously declares that we should just be more of yourself and to own your own truth. Your own truth? There is no your own truth. There is simply truth. And whether or not you acquiesce to that doesn't say anything about the truth, but it says a lot about you. There was a church just a few miles down the road from Pleasant Valley. They changed their sign last year. I was kind of glad of it because they had the same one for a long, long time. You know what it said? Truth principles that work for you. Really? That's how we determine the utility of truth, is what works for you and what works for me? I would say that presumably that would include for some folks adultery, lying, drunkenness, and murder. There's a lot of that going around. I guess that works for some people. Is that how we determine truth? It never has been, and it never will be. Living counter to the new morality is an uphill battle. Some days it feels as futile as keeping the wind from blowing. Nearly everything about the broader culture is expertly marketed to appeal to our comfort, our well-being, our safety, our satisfaction. A delicious meal, your dream vacation, a wonderful holiday, the perfect house, great sex. What is it that will fulfill you? For ages, humans have been bent toward self-indulgence. And in our advertising age, there are countless ways of making people crave things that they don't even realize they crave. But then, there is the way of Jesus. The Westminster Catechism's first question asks, what is the chief aim of man? Why are we here, in other words? The answer, as generations upon generations have discovered, is to glorify God and to enjoy Him forever. There are profound moral implications here. If the highest goal of life is God's glory rather than our own enjoyment, then our outward behaviors and inward character must take on a drastically different shape. About this, I guess it was June of 2015, Jim Dockery and I witnessed a sad spectacle in Santa Fe, New Mexico. A spectacle that reminds us that many will not accept God's truth, but insist instead on setting their own standard of truth. Jim and I came into Santa Fe the day after the Supreme Court decision legalizing same-sex marriage and making it the law of the land. We came into the town of Santa Fe, and there was a massive parade, rainbow decorations everywhere. Thousands upon thousands of people jammed into the town square celebrating freedom. Right here you can see there's a band shell, and of all things, they had an a cappella chorus get up and sing the national anthem. And as they were concluding the national anthem, they got to the line, "Or the land of the free," and they all shouted "free," and they all started cheering wildly. And you couldn't miss the point. They were saying, now we're free. Before, we've been in prison. But now the Supreme Court has seen the light, and it has changed the law to reflect the truth. I don't know that there's ever been a sadder moment I've had in my life than that. I thought, God, save us. That we think we know better than God what is truth. You see, exchanging the truth for a lie doesn't make us free. It just makes us slaves to sin. Everyone thinks that they know better than God. Here's the bottom line. No one knows better than God. No one. Okay? He made us. He knows what's best for us. Why is the truth so difficult to accept? Why is it so challenging? Because we arrogantly think that we're smarter than God, and we're not. We never have been, and we never will be. The greatest truth that mankind has ever discovered is a simple truth that's summed up in three words. Jesus is Lord. That's the truth. And honest, sincere seekers will continue to pursue that truth today. I guess it was a couple of years ago that right up in this baptistry, something kind of special took place. A fellow by the name of Ron Clark made the decision to be baptized into Christ. I remember that day really well. I was standing right up there on those steps and I was taking a picture of Cash baptizing Ron into Christ. Ron's little daughter, Rivers, was standing right up there, and she was watching her daddy be baptized into Christ. And I still remember when Cash brought Ron up out of the water. I think we got the next picture, don't we? Right there. Look in the background at Rivers. She's clapping. That's something worth clapping about. Isn't it amazing? The Bible says, and a little child shall lead them. Isn't it remarkable that a little child recognizes the greatest truth that will ever be witnessed to? When someone says Jesus is Lord and is baptized into his death, burial, and resurrection, that's truth. That's freedom. That is life-changing. And that's the truth that we continue to proclaim today. And if that truth is calling out to you, you need to obey the Lord in faith, repentance, and baptism this very hour. You need to do that. Won't you come as we stand and sing together?